Now, the words we use and how we use them say a lot about who we are, where we come from, and our place in that community. The people who nerd out studying all of that, they're called sociolinguists, and our guest is one of them. She's particularly interested in words that people use that other people might see as incorrect or ungrammatical or lazy. Think words like or or ain't. Where do you fall in words like that? Love them? Hate them? Our guest says there's no wrong way to use English, and there's a lot of history to explain where these words and feelings come from. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself using words like this? You know they're grammatically not quite right, but it just fits. Is it different depending on who you're talking to? How do people respond to it? Are you annoyed by what you see as the misuse of language? Or are you annoyed by people who correct this kind of language? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. She writes a popular language blog on Psychology Today called Language in the Wild and is a professor for the Great Courses series. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and talk with you.
Well, I could have gone with another greeting like this one.
What's up? What's up? Yo, who's that?
Yo!
So, Valerie, you write about that old classic "What's up, beer" ad, and that's an example of how we might use unusual or not quite to the rule book English language to connect with other people.
Absolutely. When we talk to each other, we're really about connection rather than grammatical correctness. And I think that sometimes we forget this when we overhear people and find what they say annoying.
Can you talk about the difference between English as a careful system of rules that we observe or not observe at our peril and language English as we actually use it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times what we do is we live in these ideas of what good language is and what bad language is based on essentially a social construction that has been around for only about 200 years, this idea of prescriptive grammar, of rules that you should follow. And I'm not saying that language has no rules. Language has a million rules, but they're cognitive and articulatory rules that guide us in understanding what people say and constructing sentences that other people will understand. But a rule like don't end a sentence with a preposition or two negatives make a positive are actually essentially made up rules in the 18th century by people that wanted English to be more like Latin. So those are social rules about what we think is proper and polite language. Those really have very little to do with the rules that underlie the system of language. And it's really more about what we think is good for making connections, for showing our social identity, for letting people understand both information about what we're trying to get across, the point or the information itself, but also ideas about how we feel about that information, how we feel about the relationship we have with that speaker, and things about our social identity, like our gender and our ethnicity. And those are really important parts of the reasons we communicate.
Now, let's get into some of the bad, I'll always throw that in quotes, English you talk about here. Go back to the 90s again, actually. The 1995 comedy Clueless demonstrates a lot of this. The main character, Cher, arguing in a high school debate class in favor of oppressed people being allowed refuge in America.
So, okay, like right now, for example, the Haitians need to come to America. But some people are all, what about the strain on our resources? But it's like when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? I said RSVP because it was a sit-down dinner. But people came that, like, did not RSVP. So I was, like, totally bugging.
All right, you tackle a lot of these words. Some of them have their own chapter in your book. Let's start with like. It appears like a meaningless word. I just said it there. I'm going to keep catching myself saying it. We often judge people who say liked too much. But hold on, you write, like is actually doing something in our sentences, Valerie.
Absolutely. It's doing a lot. And one of the reasons I think we don't like it, now we're going to notice every like we say, is because it does so many different things and we're not all on the same page about what it's doing. So all of us know like as a verb and even a noun, like your dislikes and your likes. We often use it as a preposition, like in a simile. And a lot of us have even crept into using it as a conjunction with things like it feels like, it seems like, he pretends like. And all of those likes are pretty well accepted. They don't bug us so much. But what does bug us is the new forms of like. And part of that is because of who is using them, which is often young speakers, often female speakers, two groups that we tend to disdain how they talk. But it's also because we don't maybe understand all the functions so that it feels like it's just omnipresent when really it's doing different things. And you can use like, for example, as an approximator where about would go. So he's like 12. There's no difference between saying he's like 12 and he's about 12, except for the age of the user. It's still doing that same work that the about is doing as an approximator. And you can use it as a discourse particle to express emphasis. So something like, I was waiting like 20 hours for you, where obviously it's not really 20 hours, but I'm just telling you, hey, I'm pretty annoyed with you because you were late. And so it's emphatic and hyperbolic in that sense. And we convey a lot of emotionality that way with hyperbolic statements. So it's functioning as something that we would do in a different way. So you might instead use like there instead of saying, you know, I'm really annoyed with you because you took so long. And it's much cooler, hipper way to say it. And then finally, use it as a quotative verb where you're talking not only about what someone said, but even more subtly, what they might be thinking as an event was unfolding, which is not really something you can do with the verb to say very well. So here, like adds a nuance of meaning that to say doesn't. So if I said something such as, I was like, I just can't do this. What that's telling my listener is that's not necessarily something I verbatim said. It's what I was thinking in the moment that the event I'm describing was happening, which is different than I said, if I've said, and I said, I just can't do this, which would convey an actual verbatim quote. So there it's actually adding a really useful nuance of meaning. I think our objection with like is that sometimes it feels like people overuse it. And that's very different. Because someone might overuse it in a context doesn't mean the word itself is meaningless. It just means maybe that person is using it a little excessively.
We're talking to Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics in the English department in the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how the language changes? Do you have a generation gap in your family where maybe kids or grandkids use words or phrases that are more or less unintelligible to you or annoyingly incorrect as you hear it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Valerie Friedland, linguistics professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers. Richard is with us in Manitowoc. Richard, hi.
Hi. It's been driving me crazy. I listen to NPR all day long, and I notice a lot of times they answer questions with an answer, but they put a little inflection on the end of the answer, like it's a question. And I just drive me nuts lately, and I didn't know why they're doing this so often more than I've ever heard before.
Richard, thanks for the call. Valerie, I think it's this thing called uptalk.
Yes, definitely called uptalk. But if you're a linguist, we call it a high rising terminal, just to be fancy. Ooh. And make it sound impressive. And what's really interesting is intonation patterns often vary by speaker. They vary by language and they might vary by dialect. But when one intonation pattern gets associated very much with some sort of pragmatic information, like signaling that this is going to be a question, then people get really tied to that one meaning associated with that intonational pattern. And that's what's happened with this high rising terminal. We hear it often when we are finishing a question. And so because of that use in one context, we have then generalized that to other contexts so that when people use high rising terminals to indicate continuation, meaning they're going to keep talking, they're not finished with what they're going to say, which is where we find it used in this way that the caller was talking about. Mm-hmm. Those that are really used to it being a question intonation pattern find it really difficult to see it as something different. But for those that use it, which is often women. There have been certainly studies that show women use more uptalk than men. It seems to indicate that they're not done talking yet. And if you look at the history of women's and women's speech, we find that women tend to be interrupted at a much higher rate than men do, which seems to suggest that people don't read their cues of continuing what they're going to say or feel that it's okay to interrupt them. And so what we find is women have often adopted some speech habits that help encourage the keeping of their turn or proper turn alignment between speakers. And high rising terminal seems to be one of those where if we do a test, which we have done with perception tests, and we have high rising terminals and we ask people what it means, it usually means either a question or in the middle of a sentence, when they're sort of continuing on, it means generally a non-finality. So people seem to read it as that person's continuing what they're going to say and I shouldn't break in. And I think that's really why it's become more prevalent in speech today.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call. And Valerie, a couple things you said remind me of this paradox in your book. Young women speakers, I think, are most commonly made fun of anyone for things they may do differently. But if you want to study the future of a language, look toward young women because they're the ones who develop the things that end up coming into place in the future. What's going on?
Absolutely. A lot of our linguistic disdain is targeted towards women and young women in particular. And it's partially because young women are the innovators in language. Even when we look several centuries back at letters and diaries from the early modern period, new changes coming into the language, like starting to say does and has instead of doth and hath, starting to say you for subjects instead of ye and things like that, starting to use progressive forms of verbs to indicate habitual or continuous action. All of these things were brought into the language through women's speech. We see much higher rates of these novel features in early modern letters and diaries in women's language. And then fast forward to modern times, again, things like using literally, non-literally, using like as an intensifier, these forms that we don't really love, using going to instead of will, those are all led by young women. So we have this pattern where young women lead in language change. We also have this pattern where historically young women's voices are not welcome in public forums, and we tend to disdain their voices themselves. And so you put that in a mix, in a blender, and what you come up with is dislike for young women's voices because they're doing new things that we're not used to, that we consider rule-breaking. And there are also voices that we don't tend to love in those contexts anyway. And so doing something new and novel when you're already a disfavored group tends to get you in trouble. And that's pretty much what we find with young women's features today.
Talking to Valerie Friedland, her new book is Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Back to your calls now. Marshall is with us in Price County. Marshall, hi.
Hey, how are you? I'm wondering why people always say, I mean, when they're getting...
Oh, Marshall, you're breaking up a little bit, but that's starting the conversation or the sentence with, I mean, blah, blah, or people, and I do this sometimes, so blah, 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 blah. Why do we set up our new topics that way, Valerie?
You know, it's funny. I mean, and so are two of the things I hear about the most when people talk about things that annoy them, in addition to the ones in the book. And both of those are in a category that we call discourse markers, which are words that often come at the beginning of a sentence that serve to do something to the organization or structure of what you're saying, where they either relate it back to what was previously said, or in the cases of those in particular, they are trying to orient the listener to a particular stance or opinion that the speaker has. So usually when you say so at the beginning of a sentence, it follows something that requires additional explanation before you get to the point that directly addresses the thing that was before. It's called the backstory so. So when someone, and I just put it there, so when someone says so at the beginning of a statement, it usually means that I'm going to take a little diversion from the direct answer to what you said so that I can explain some other additional component of meaning here that's going to be relevant to what I'm going to say to answer your question. And then I mean usually clarifies something that was previously said, often something a speaker said themselves, and then they'll say something and say, I mean, I didn't really think that, where they're doing a little extra clarification than they're sort of signaling to the listener that this clarification is about to take place. So they're both listenership devices. They're helping with the conversational structure. And we find when we look at research on who uses those kinds of markers more often, discourse markers, it tends to be people that rank high on conscientious scales on psychological tests. So it's actually to help with conversational flow. Sometimes people use them excessively and we start to notice them. But if we look at studies on people that compared passages with discourse markers and those without, people feel the discourse markers help with the flow and make it less robotic than when they're absent.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Lisa and Madison, who couldn't stay on the line, wondering why some people pronounce the T in some words like a D, like little versus little. And I was thinking, Valerie, reading your book about T's, like the sentence, "Do you want some butter on your toast?" If I say, "Do you want some butter on your toast?" Those are two very different sentences. They mean something different about me. With just a minute left, the meaning of how we pronounce those letters.
Well, T is very handy because it does provide a big shortcut to speaker identity. So if you say, "You want some butter," then that tells me I'm a Cockney speaker, right? It tells you something about where I come from. If I say, "You want some butter," that identifies you as an American speaker because it's called a flap. That T that's pronounced like a D between a stressed and unstressed syllable is something that only developed in the United States after most of the colonists had settled here. So British speakers either glottalize, so butta, or they pronounce the T, butta. But an American says butter.
Thanks for that question. And Valerie, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called "Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English." Do you want some butter on your toast? That sounds sinister to me. Like, I'd see that character in a movie. I don't think I like that character.